Episode 3 of Beerfest Brewers Roundtables. So this one features another three guests, well, actually four. The formal guests were Blacks of Kinsale, Hopfully, and Wicklow Brewing Company. But we were also joined by Will Avery, who used to be the head brewer with Galway Bay Brewing. He's since moved on, but he has a huge knowledge of what our current topic was, which was hops. So this was interesting. We got into the role of hops, how they became so dominant in modern brewing, their origins. And we also got into a bit of a rant about Untappd and about a lot of other things. I think it's another one you'll enjoy. It's another one I enjoyed actually doing. So here we go. Thanks everyone for coming and joining us today. Hopefully we're in for a good chat. We have Chris from Hopfully, Ronan from Blacks, and Brian from Wicklow. And so I thought maybe somebody would enlighten me first. IPAs. Can someone clarify exactly what they are? My understanding is that one, they're an ale, two, they're very pale, and then they're Indian, which seems to mean hops. So anybody want to jump off there and explain to me the three separate sections so I know exactly what an IPA is? Ronan, how about you?
Go on, so. Well, basically, it's one of these styles that has, you know, just expanded over, I'd say, probably the last 10, 15 years anyway. Like, originally, it was kind of heavily hopped ales for kind of the kind of preserving the beer for long journeys from England to India, and that's kind of where the name came about. But over the last 10, 15 years, they're nothing like they used to be, and it just kind of implies that it would obviously be an ale, with a couple of little kind of subcategories of that, and usually kind of heavily hopped, on more on the bitter side traditionally. But I think we've a couple of New Englands in the lineup there, which is another new subcategory of IPA that isn't so much focused on the bitterness, but more about heavily hopping for hop flavors. So having the other side of it, you know, not boiling them up for quite as much and just trying to make kind of a juicy, smooth kind of a beer. But traditionally it would be a heavily hopped ale, so much more bitter, with more kind of floral characteristics than your traditional ones, where you're looking to really promote the hops and let the hops shine through the malt more than, say, you would with a stout or a dark ale or a red, for instance.
Right. So the ale would then be, that's top fermented, obviously it's pale. Yeah. So then it's just the hops really is what classifies it as an IPA.
Yeah, and even the ale, you know, like you can get a black IPA now, you can get a red IPA, you can probably get a brown IPA and a green IPA now next week, you know. But it's one of these terms that it's just expanded massively to have so many different subcategories that the actual lettering of the India Pale Ale doesn't really apply to the modern style, I don't think, you know.
Right.
And nothing prevents you to use the lager string for that either. So
yeah, I kind of didn't want to go into that because it would be a whole other category of that. Yeah, so you can have an India Pale Lager, which is also an IPA.
Yeah.
So basically,
you can pretty much write IPA on anything nowadays, you know. You can, you know, just call your stout a black IPA. Not many you know, if you, whether it's malt bitterness or hop bitterness that you've got coming through there, people will just drink it and either like it or not like it, you know. But writing IPA on the can or bottle is definitely a way to get people to pick it up off the shelf, I think.
So as a category, it sounds like it doesn't really mean anything anymore. It's just beer. It's just, but with slightly more hops than maybe a stout or a lager.
Yeah. It's more about kind of showcasing hops and having hops as a kind of the dominant theme of the beer, so to speak.
And there are different styles, right? I think when people see IPAs, well, that's a broad category, but when I think craft beer drinkers, they kind of know what to expect when they see, a West Coast IPA or a New England style. So I think it's important to have that in for the customer to understand what is in the can. Because I think most people understand what it is. You can do pretty much everything you want to do, but you still have the, those styles that it makes it easier for the customer to actually, reach out for the can. And when they go for an IPA, I'd say that they're expecting to have something based on what they're reading on the label. So,
okay.
Yeah. The kind of IPA is a kind of a major category. It's very kind of muddled up. But then when you get down to it, you kind of say this is a session IPA, a West Coast, a New England, a black, or, just a hot bomb, basically, Then category is a bit more defined, where, if you wrote New England IPA on the label and you had a kind of a reddish, super hoppy, kind of very bitter beer, you probably wouldn't go down to the level. But the, kind of that overall grouping of IPAs is just, it's too big to be categorized by one single thing, I think.
Right. Yeah, that's where I always get, to be honest, IPAs are the thing that intimidate me as kind of you come to buy beer and there's so much, like you said, subcategories. And it's just like, where do you go or what does it mean? And that they're the ones that kind of, I think from, unless you're already in the craft beer thing well into it, you kind of can get very intimidated by what exactly you're getting or what you're, and that's always that threw me off.
We try and give a few hints on the back of the can, but the front of the can is just about grabbing your attention and, getting into that niche.
And brewers keep coming up with new stuff. You have, nowadays you have the sour IPAs, you have the milkshake IPAs. So, and I think that's going to, that's going to keep add on to the list. That's
right.
That's an ongoing thing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's helped clear. Yeah. I think Paul here had a question as well. What's the difference between a pale ale and an IPA? But I think basically what you've said is just less hops.
Yeah. So a pale ale would still be on the hoppier side of things, but an IPA should be that little step above it, kind of IBU wise and kind of hop utilization wise.
And is there some sort of accepted limit of like under this amount of hops it's just a pale ale and over that it's
no there would be ECB kind of guidelines and stuff for it, but like there's nothing making any brewery decide to call one thing a pale or one thing an IPA. You're not going to get done for misinformation on a can label or something, because as Chris was saying there, this whole new thing of these milkshake IPAs where there's a lot of hops in them, but they're quite viscous and sweet, so like how is that an IPA? It probably shouldn't be called an IPA.
Yeah. we had this conversation there a couple of weeks ago as well. The difference between a porter and a stout is, and nobody could come up with a definition of that either. So it was just whatever. Yeah.
That was the original kind of argument, 10 years ago. If you were into your beer, you'd have to have a discussion about the difference between porter and stout. But now I think, maybe we're getting to the point where we need to have a little bit of a conversation with ourselves about, not everything can be an IPA. Yeah. If you've a lactose, milky, marshmallow and chocolate cream ale, just because you put some hops into it, can you still really call that an IPA?
Yeah.
But then I wouldn't buy a marshmallow cream ale, but I might buy a marshmallow IPA. So
okay.
It's a marketing.
Well, that's exactly it. It's just down to what people will buy, and if they see IPA, they know what it is. That's it.
Yeah, and it gets them to pick it up off the shelf anyway. I think that's half the battle when you're trying to sell somebody a beer and you're sitting in a range of hundreds of different products. We've got some very different kind of artwork and stuff that we can work with. But essentially, once somebody's picked it up, I'd say there's probably a 70% chance that they're taking it home.
Right. Yeah. So look, I each of you have a different type of subcategory of IPAs, which I think could make this kind of interesting. Maybe, Ronan, you have what? It's a hazy IPA. I think that's what categorizes it apart from the fact that it's hazy? Like, what makes that?
Well, like technically, it would be a New England IPA, but you know, the bitterness is quite high in it because we use cryo hops, so it wouldn't be quite as juicy as Chris's hopefully one there. But yeah, it's one of those. It kind of fits in between those two guidelines, and I think, you know, the sales guys just decided that, you know, a hazy IPA versus a New England IPA, you know, just putting the word hazy in there, it kind of defines it nearly as this New England style. It is kind of low bitterness and quite juicy and fruity that it's pushing towards that kind of side of things. But I'd say, like, I didn't boil any hops for it. So, like, me personally, I think that, you know, if you're going to do a New England, you don't boil hops, you know. That was kind of the original thesis behind these New England was, you know, you don't boil hops. You don't try and convert the acids in the hops into bitterness. You just go in at the back end and you pick them up in different ways, you know.
Right. So you got there. I mean, what's your definition of, you know, a hazy IPA? Would this be a classical one or is it?
There's a lot of haze in it, you know. So I put a lot of malted wheat and oats into it. So the dog just won't fill up there. A lot of protein in a beer, which gives it this kind of this richer kind of a mouthfeel. And that haze then, you know, if I see easy IPA on the can, then I'm obviously going to be looking for a beer with like a lot of mouthfeel, and you know, it's not going to be like super clean, crisp. You know, it's going to be juicy and kind of full-bodied, kind of a style of beer. You know? And just very, very kind of floral, very aromatic hops, and
I know. Like, I know the hops is the thing I'm really not familiar with. It's something that I've only started to really realize how the definition and how the, you know, how refined, I suppose, and how, you know, how delicate they can be. It's only something, because like I said, I think the IPA, I mean, this is what kind of kick-started the whole craft brewing in America, isn't it? They went down the IPAs.
It's something that smaller breweries could do. You know, like, I know probably everybody out there has tried doing a lager, but you know, you're not going to compete with the likes of Heineken and Molson and these guys. You know, they can just bang out such a consistent, clean, crisp product all the time. Where to do that on my equipment, it just ties me up for so much longer.
Okay.
You know, I can get there, you know, I can make a great lager, but, you know, the price point and that end of the market just isn't really there. Whereas I think the craft movement started more with people that, you know, they were kind of done with lager. You know, they taste one of these pale ales and kind of, oh, Jesus, it's beer with flavor and, you know, it has different things going on with it. So that's why they continue to buy those. I suppose you could say that the pale ale and the IPA kind of started it. But I just shared about a pale ale there. It was probably, you know, we're all around the same kind of age there, apart from yourself, Brian, sorry. But, you know, that was probably one of the first kind of craft beers that we drank. And, you know, you try that and kind of go, geez, it's really easy drinking. There's flavor in it. You know, it's really good quality beer. It's probably the first hoppy beer that I had. I grew up in Belgium, so I grew up with a lot of sweet beer.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, so yeah, I suppose Belgians are sweet, but they've also got the sour tradition as well, I suppose. But yeah, the hops.
Would you kind of hops with
Belgians, really, would you?
No, not really, no. And like, you know, when you're 13, 14, 15, like you're not going for sours because they're too expensive and you can't really drink much of them. But, you know, the multi pack of Leff in the corner there, it's 6.6%. Like you get a few of those into you and, at that age, you're well on your way. You know, you're enjoying it. That was it was Belgian bushing, I suppose. You know, there were no flagons of with Devil's Bit or whatever. You know, good quality beer.
Yeah, no, I mean they are good. So yeah, look, I'm going to go. Will Avery's here. He's going to come, so I'm going to just ask him up here. A question here. Well, I'm going to try and reposition where everybody is on the screen now because I'm. So, you know, Sorry, Will's there. Sorry, I'm just going to reposition things as if not done me here because Ronan's in the middle of the thing and I don't think that's fair. So
I've done my time now.
You've done your time. I'll add everybody else in here. Let me just rearrange the screen for it. So, yeah, so Will, you're, thanks for coming on. You're obviously, for anybody who doesn't know, the rest of you know him, I guess, with Loughran's Malt, and you're a bit of an expert on the hops, I believe.
Well, some people tell me I am, but I don't claim that myself. I just really like hops and all things hops, and just over my 15 years in the beer industry, I've acquired a lot of knowledge. So, all right. Thanks for having me on today.
So yeah, so let's just talk hops specifically. I mean, what it originally was, if I'm right, was primarily to kind of disinfect the beer, and then, as you said, that the aromatics were almost a secondary, that the aromatics and flavor were almost a secondary, probably back like a few centuries ago. It was just primarily to disinfect the beer, and then you can start playing with the different strains to give it the flavor.
Yeah, so like there's a bit of a historical conundrum there in that yes, you do have the secondary aspect of hops to disinfect beer, but there has to be something else in beer to balance out sweetness. If you drink a beer that has no hops or no bittering aspect, you just end up with a cloying sweet mess, I guess. And historically, you would have gruits that were bittered with different types of herbs and whatnot, and hops just happened to come in and be able to serve a couple of functions, to be able to provide that balance from sweetness and bitterness. And also, as Ronan alluded to earlier, with the introduction of India Pale Ale, provided with the alpha acid content of hops was a deterrent to nasty bugs like Lactobacillus and Pediococcus. So there's kind of a dual purpose there historically.
And the strain, sorry, Paul, at the moment they're on the Ace of Haze. So Ron has just been telling us where he got the, you know, that what it's about and all that. So that's what they're drinking right now. So anybody else got a question there before I go off and come up with another one? No. So how many, like, strain hops, they're now obviously commercial and you have single strains and they're growing everywhere and that. So how do you decide what hops, how do you know what flavor and how you can blend them? Do you come into it with a clear picture of what you're trying to make and what you want the flavor to be? Or do you come out and kind of play with it and then just add a bit more and just experiment, or how do you decide what hops you want to use?
Well, thankfully, a lot of us actually list the hops as separate ingredients on our beers. So say for like the other day, I had Chris's one there, and you know, he lists the hop varieties on the back there. So he's Azaka, Amarillo, Comet, etc. So when you're drinking that, then you get a feel of what those hops are going to bring to the party. And you know, everybody's palate is slightly different then. I kind of go, oh, if it was a little bit less citrusy now, it might be towards it or that way, you know. But there's so many different commercial beers out there, and you know, we've all brewed quite a few different beers at this stage on you know, whether it's homebrew scale or at work. So we kind of have a general idea, and then yeah, it is a shot in the dark then when you go for a new beer and you throw in those hops, you'll see what kind of balance you get at the back end.
And Will, how many strains of hops do you list?
Oh, in the portfolio of hops that we sell, we've probably got between our American varieties, our New Zealand varieties, and our German varieties, I would say around 40. But I mean, they're hundreds. They're varieties of hops that people have never heard of. I mean, I'm just drinking this hopefully banger here. One thing that really makes me happy about a beer like this is it's got two hops, maybe three, that people don't use a whole lot of. The fact that there's Comet in that beer is absolutely fantastic. It's an old school hop that that provides a lot of aroma and can provide some similar flavors and aromas to Citra and really complement Citra. And Citra itself is the widest grow, is the most acres devoted to Citra of any hop in the world. And to be able to take a hop like Comet and complement a hop like Citra is absolutely brilliant. Good use of that hop there, Chris. Fantastic beer.
Thanks. Hops, there are some, you know, old school hops, especially if you're, you know, when you're talking about late edition in the kettle, you want to understand, you know, the amount of oils that is actually, you know, it's being transferred to your fermenter, and, you know, and roughly what the losses are going to be after fermentation, because that's going to give you a hint of, you know, what the beer is going to taste like. It's going to, you know, the aroma is going to be like from the late hop edition. And I've been doing a lot of pilots using Columbus and Fogel, right? Which they are one of the best hops for late edition. Like Columbus, especially, like the rate, if you get the average rate of transfer of oils to the fermenter of all hops is about 19%. When you use Columbus in late hops, you've got about 94% of the, you know, the oils that you want while fermenting the beer. Like this is all, you know, it's all a bunch of complex stuff, but it's really important to understand, you know, whatever we know about the science of it. I mean, I don't think we know a lot. I don't know a lot. I've been studying a lot of hops as well, but it's kind of a rabbit hole, you know. There's a lot in there, and there's a lot about the hops that, you know, that we've kind of lost track of because we're coming up with this new, you know, hops all the time, and the styles that we all love right now are, you know, the citrusy and the tropical fruit flavors. But I think there's a lot of the, you know, the old style hops that we can still use, especially for that type of beer that, you know, this the New England style. Or so, yeah, I've been trying to use a lot of those old school hops.
Yeah, and just to jump in there a little bit, the three most popular aroma hops in the world are Citra, Simcoe, and Mosaic. Well, around 50% of the global hop acreage is now. This isn't just speaking to American acreage. This is global hop acreage. Around 50% of all acres of hops are Citra, Simcoe, and Mosaic. And Chris brought up a really good point there. That classic hops: Cascade, Centennial, Chinook, Columbus, Amarillo, possibly, which could be the OG. Fruity hop, the original hop for hazy style juice and beers. We're currently in a position agriculturally and agronomically specifically in that farmers grow what's going to sell for the most money. They're not just out planting Cascade for the crack. They're not doing it altruistically. They're going to plant what they can sell for the most money. So hop farmers are shifting their volume from classic varieties to varieties like Citra. Now, where that becomes a problem is Citra, for example, is a hop that yields 8 bales per acre, which is very low on the threshold of what makes a viable hop. That's not a lot of kilos per acre. Whenever you compare that to a hop like Cascade or Centennial, which is 13 to 16 bales per acre. But what's happening right now is farmland is being transitioned from a hop that yields high volume to hops that yield low volume. And what that is going to do is, number one, it's going to, even though more is being grown, it's going to continually to increase the price of hops like Citra and Mosaic, because you're having to devote more land to a low yielding hop, but it's also going to artificially increase the price of hops like Cascade, Chinook, Columbus, Centennial, even Amarillo, because you've got to pull back in, and you have to convince farmers to still grow those. So from my point of view, and from a agricultural point of view, brewers need to continue to use those hops and figure out how to make them.
Definitely.
Like Chris has done with Comet in this beer. And I know from past conversations with Chris, one of his favorite hops is Chinook. Like, yeah. Like incorporate those into hazy IPAs, because they do have a place. And that in and of itself is going to make the hop industry more sustainable. Like nobody wants to look around the corner and see €25 a kilo Cascade. Like, that's not good for anybody. And that's the direction things are heading.
Balance, but like, I think you probably say yourself, Will and Chris, that you know you see these new hop varieties coming onto the market, and you just can't look past them, really.
No,
you know, like say Strata or any of these, you know, that have come out for that couple of years, like they just sell so well, and like you write down the can, people are picking it up. That's what they want, you know. Now, like I have a Cascade and Simcoe and. IPA just in the fermenter there is packing out in the next couple of weeks, but like, you know, that's old school hops. And you know, I know what you're saying there, that if we don't use these hop varieties, you know, we will lose them. And you know, we're very, very small consumers of hops in the kind of global scheme of things, you know, the few lads that we have here, you know. But I think it's all about balance, and like, you know, you can't just rely on Citra, because you know what if something happens to Citra one year? Do you know, like the numbers on that are bouncing around all over the place, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the alpha acid has held pretty steady now for the last couple of years, but a few years ago, like that dropped way down, you know, and like that could drop off by 20-30%. So the everybody needs 20-30% more of it if they're going to hit their target IBUs, you know. So it's,
and
it's a great game to be playing, but it's enjoyable. But I would like to see more kind of unique and different hop varieties. And at the moment, those unique different hop varieties are old school hops that people aren't using, you know?
Yeah. And do you think that that's a positive or a negative? Like you said, on the cans, you're writing the hops that you have, but... Most people probably don't understand the difference. So are you then?
I think they do.
People to try something new, or is it driving them? Look, it's I don't care, so I just go with what.
If you talk to people that are really into their beer, you know, you can ask them what their favorite hop is, and they'll kind of go, "Oh, it's Mosaic. I love Mosaic. There's Mosaic in it. I'm drinking it. That's it." You know, and you know, if they see that on the can, they're like, "Oh, I'm picking that up." You know.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like that's a. As a percentage of beer drinkers, like the people who know that level of stuff is still very, very small. So if you're talking to
someone paying €7 for a can of beer and an off license, they know what they're looking for. And you know, you go out and you spend €7-8 on one of these imported cans of beer, and you know, it doesn't hit the spot for you. You can just kind of
information. But here's the thing, I think it's our job as brewers to actually introduce those hops or those old school hops and come up with great products that people can drink and, you know, say like, wow, we're missing out here. It's not just about Citra and Mosaic and Simcoe.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, there's something else out there. So that's kind of our job.
I said, I drank one of yours there the other day and kind of went, Jesus, Azaka. Fucking hell. You know, I used to brew a little bit with Taka, and I really liked it, but it had just completely fallen off my radar. And I was just like, oh, no, I'm throwing Idaho 7 at everything this year, because that's what people want, you know? But, it just got me thinking straight away, and I was like, Azaka and Amarillo, lovely combination. And it's, I think this beer tastes completely different to any of the New England IPAs that are out on the market at the moment, because the choice that you've made there.
Yeah, well, and there's another thing, like you mentioned a few minutes ago about the, you know, like, well, if it's a New England, there is no, hot side additions. Now, I like New England's, But yeah. I think most of them are cloying.
Yeah.
I like the balance that I of that beer because I actually used boiling hops. Like that beer is Comet all through the boiling side, all through the hot side. It's just Comet. Like Azaka, Amarillo, and Citra are actually secondary there because it's mostly Comet.
I do get a lot of the Comet pulling through on that, Chris. Yeah. It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And I actually think for me in drinking this beer, I had one last night to actually drink it and think about it to be able to talk about it during today. But it's rare that I drink a DDH IPA that advertises Citra on the label, and Citra is the hop I taste the least. Citra is very much in the background, I absolutely love. Like for me and my palate, I'm tired of drinking every IPA that either tastes like Citra or Mosaic. And the fact that you're using, like I said, Azaka, Comet, and Amarillo in that, I mean, that's a great combination. And for me, from my point of view, and you touched on it there a second ago, is that a lot of these New England IPAs are just so sweet. And they're thick, and while they start nice, they finish like sex without an orgasm, I think. There's just no finish to it. Hits you up front and then just finishes flat. And I think that what you've done brilliantly with that beer, and what I try to talk to brewers about, if you're going to have that huge double dry hop nose of tropical intensity, like, you've got to throw something in there to balance that out. Like, you've got to have a contrasting aspect of it. Like throw in, as you did, some Amarillo or some Comet that may bring a little bit of grapefruit or a little bit of pine or a little bit of dank. Throw that in as a contrasting element to lift up your juicy elements. If all you've got is juice on the palate, you're not going to appreciate the juice for what it is. But when you've got that little bit of contrast to it, then that juicy element is going to be lifted because your brain is actually comparing the juice to the pine, for example.
I didn't technically boil any hops, but my Whirlpool additions were massive. You know, and I kept the Whirlpool at 85, so I was using a lot of cryo, so I knew that I was going to get that bitterness that I needed, because that whole just super juicing, I find, you know, you take a sup and you're immediately thirsty after it, and you're like, it's not fucking right, you know? You're drinking beer because you're thirsty, and it is just, as you said, it's cloying, like, it's, you know, finding that balance, which I think a good few of the American imports that I've had recently, I'm actually wearing a KCBC shirt there, but I had one of their beers, and it was all laid on fruity, juicy hops, and it was tough work getting through it. Like, it was 7% alcohol fruit juice, basically, and and the carbonation was low on it. It just didn't really do it for me, you know? And I hope that this whole new wave of fucking lactose-infused New Englands isn't going to be a thing, because it's like an alcohol-pop, really. You know, I can't really take to that as a style. I might have to brew one, but that's another story.
what you're talking about there, Ronan, like, I feel that when I was cutting my teeth in the craft beer world, obviously, West Coast IPAs, like, that's all that existed. Like, there was no such thing as a New England IPA. There wasn't a juicy anything. It was
Full Sail that pushed the boundaries of IBU.
Even going back to brewing in America, I remember I went to a seminar once at the Craft Brewers Convention. John Mallett, who is one of the head guys in charge at Bell's Brewery in Michigan, He was given a seminar on IPA, and his quote was, "I want to make my IPAs taste like a cat ate my weed and pissed on a pine tree."
On the can, I'd be so disappointed. But
and you think about those older IPAs, that's what a lot of them tasted like. It was piney, catty, dank, just beers that whenever you drank, you wanted to have another one of the exact same beer. Like it made you thirstier for the
nothing
same.
Else will do. Like your palate is gone after one.
And I think the trend we've gone to now with IPA is you want to drink this beer and your next one, you want it to be something different because the one you just had didn't hit that spot that you needed it to. The analogy that I like to use is that it's kind of like sometimes it feels like New England IPAs have become the Spotify of the world, where you're just hitting keeping on going to the next track rather than like digging into an album and really appreciating like what that bit has to offer. You're just on to the next one to see if it can fill the hole that the last one didn't fill, I guess.
Definitely, man. And you know, I was mad into Untappd for years, you know. And then you actually start kind of brewing and producing and putting your own beers out in the world there, and you're kind of going, "Fuck, this thing is it's just changing the beer culture." There's so much new beer out there that, like, you know, trying to get somebody to drink the same beer more than two times is massive. Like, it's you've just got to be putting out fresh, new, you know. We can all brew like kind of technical, difficult styles and all the rest of it, but when you've got to be coming up with a couple of different beers every month, it's easy to just kind of go, "I have a great malt base here. I'm just going to change up the hops, throw a load of them at it, and fuck it, it's going to be sold like that," you know. I think there's a bit of laziness on our part as well, where you know with the New England style, it is very much just about switching out the hops. Once you get your kind of malt base set, you know, you tweak it a little bit. You might up the ABV or lower the ABV or try and get a little bit something else out of it. But, you know, switching out the hops is just easy done, you know?
I do think there's a counterpoint to that, though. Like, there are some hop combinations that just don't work.
I found one. Like, did you ever hear of Medusa?
I've brewed with Medusa and it's absolute trash. Like, no one should ever brew with Medusa.
Or red IPA, I think it might work, you know.
Sabu's ugly brother, I guess.
I threw the recipe in the bin.
So it's not just that easy. I think there are some people that are just absolutely killing it with the hop combinations. Like, you look at some of the guys in the UK at Daya and Verdant and some of those guys, and like, they're absolutely just killing it. And it's not always just the same beer, the same base over and over, but they're pulling some unique flavors out of hop combinations. And I think that Chris, you're doing the same thing, and Ronan, some of the new beers you're slamming out there, doing the same thing. Like, you're finding hop combinations that absolutely work, and it's great.
Yeah,
actually, Ronan, Chris, the point that Ronan made there, that the fact that you have to come up with new beers all the time. I mean, as Hopley, are you going to keep this? How long will you keep this one around? Is it a single batch that's then gone and you will never bring back again? Because everybody seems to be raving about it. I mean, it's getting everybody. Yeah. Do you do if everybody?
Do it again, man. Do it again.
It is nice that, you know, you get that reaction, but it's even better if you can get that when you come up with something even better, right? It's really just about learning. Mm. Well, it's nice that combination worked. So what's next?
Yeah.
It's
like a chef, you know, you taste.
Yeah.
The chefs have their signature dish as well that they produce forever, it seems, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You always want to tweak it a little bit for the next batch.
Yeah, like we last year we launched a mango IPA as well with Idaho 7 Osaka, which Denise sucks, which I really like that beer.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one, and that was the small can of the session.
Yeah.
I remember getting that and kind of going, Jesus, who are these guys, you know? And
yeah, it was a really nice one.
Are you still contract brewing with Metalman? Is it
Metalman? Yeah.
I was amazed by that. Just to kind of go and the price point that you got that beer in at was outstanding. You know, to get a contract brew beer in that 4 for $10 range.
Yeah,
50 a can range. Now that we can't call it 4 for $10, but the hop profile and the body on it, I just thought it was absolutely smashing. Like that beer really kind of put you on my radar, so to speak, you know, and any Hoffley beer that I've seen since then, I know that it's going to be to a very, very high standard.
Yep. Agreed.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Yeah. I still like using fruits. You know, I have a lot of recipes that I have in my mind here. I've been working with some other ingredients as well. But in terms of IPAs, I really want to, you know, I have at least 6 or 7 batches of, you know, corny kegs fermenting right now that I'm dry hopping with different, you know, hops, and it's mostly old school. So I'm kind of really trying to understand those hops and see what works with what. We're launching the California Uncommon again next week.
Brilliant.
And
that California's common style, just for
Brian
there, who's a little bit lost with the IPA style. That California Uncommon is.
No, I have a lot of exploring to do on these. I know that. That's why I thought it was great to have you to come on, so you can educate me. Because I'll be honest, one of the things that hit me, you know, I would have been more into the dark grays and all that. But the thing that always got me when I tried hop new beers was, we're getting to that one next, that is actually a good point. But would be that, you know, the mass produced stuff, they've now started throwing hops into everything, and it's just like overpowering with, there is no flavor. It's just kind of it's cheap hops, you know? And that when I tried it that way, it put me off trying good hop-based beers, because I just had this overwhelming cheap hop flavor that they just throw in because everybody wants hops, you know, because IPAs are popular.
If you're using kind of concentrated syrups and stuff, I'm doing a kind of an engineering course, and as part of that, the brewing engineering side, we went and visited Heineken, and you know, I was like, oh, you know, show me your hop storage, whatever, you know. The only beer they actually put real pellet hops into is Beamish, actually. And all the Heineken stuff, it's a 200-liter drum of highly concentrated, very dense syrup that they have to keep in a small little designated room that fits 2 barrels, and the room is at 35, 40 degrees, because otherwise it won't flow through the pipe. And there's a little flow meter attached, and 2 liters of this juice goes into the lager, and say for one of their hoppy pale ale, or right. The Q4, I think it is. But we just put the same stuff, but twice as much. Not do it.
So that's what put me off hoppy beers for a long time, because I had that, and it's only recently I've started to understand it, to begin to appreciate, or to even have the palate to kind of start to spot the changes. But Brian down there in Wicklow, I mean, you've got one there, your Locknut. I don't know if you can hear me because it looked like a bad signal, but your Locknut, you're doing it. You've chosen the yeast is different as well. It's more of a kveik, or I don't know how to pronounce it. But does that make a difference?
Yeah, kveik, or the kveik yeast. So that kind of throws off a lot of fruity esters anyway. So the kind of ones, a lot of citrus kind of esters come off it. So that kind of lends well to the IPA style, because obviously citrus hops and that type of thing. So this one as well, it's a bit low.
5.2.
Sorry?
It's quite unusual to see a kveik at low ABV.
Yeah, it's just we're sitting around, we've had our WB40 and we've a couple on tap here at the moment, and we're like, you know what, we want something where we can sit around and drink all day. So we said, right, we'll keep it at 5.2 and just make it a bit more of a I wouldn't say session, but sessionable beer. So then, we decided to go along the fruit route then as well. So we threw in what about 80 kg of fresh fruit straight into the boil, just took the last kind of 10 minutes just to give it a bit of a sterilization. And then just Whirlpool hops all the way, Mosaic, straight in, you know. And that's kind of what we came out with. So it is a hazy IPA.
You put into the boil, is that?
Yeah, the fruit, yeah. We put it in for the last bit 10 minutes, just kind of get a bit of extraction out of it and try to get a little bit of caramelization, but that didn't come true.
Added fruit. I thought it was all from the quake. That's quite interesting.
No, there's about what, 70 kg there, so it's, and all hand chopped by myself, so it was a fun day.
I thought you would have gone down the puree route and just bought it in.
I did. I was laziness. I was tempted, but I said, you know what, I might as well do a bit of work. You know, get the hands dirty.
In our mango IPA, I used about 10% of the volume of mango puree. So we brewed a 20 pack, so I used 240 kilos. Now, that beer actually, it took about 3 weeks in the tank to condition because it was so thick. Mm. It took 3 weeks in the tank and another 3 weeks in the can to mellow out. Mm. So how did you find working with the mango?
To be honest with you, the first 3 days after fermentation, like this thing was, it tasted like, you know, fruit juice, and I was kind of going, oh, shit. But it mellowed out kind of within around the 21-day mark. It was just perfect. Like right before canning, I was kind of happy with it. It was kind of perfect. So I'd say about 3 weeks in total, like, you know. And with the vec itself, it was only, I think it was 26 hours fermentation. So, you know.
Yeah.
You had to eat through all of that sugar. And able for those long chain sugars, and it got through it all.
Got through it all, like right down. It is at 35 degrees as well, so I suppose that does help. But it's a Horn of Dahl Quebec East. It's phenomenal, you know, absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. As I say, there was some mess in the brewery the day that you threw 80 kilos of fresh fruit into the kettle.
Yeah, no, I have an assistant brewer, so I just walked away.
Peeling a mango is not for the faint of heart. Those are some slippery, slimy little critters.
They got in everywhere. Everywhere. It was just I had to pull apart all sorts of things just to get it out. But it was fun.
Well, I mean, you're not doing this. This is a one-off beer, is it?
I've got a second batch in the tank. It just sold so quick. We kind of thought it'd take about a month to sell, but it kind of disappeared on us. So we've done a second batch, and after that, now I don't know. It might stay around, and we'll see.
What's your batch size there, below, Brian?
That's it's 1750. So
cool.
We can double that up as well.
There's a lovely pickup off it for that edition. It's one thing I always struggle with. I know this whole conversation is about hops, but the fruit addition side of it, you know, I've tried a few different ones there, and you know, you just keep throwing fruit purees, and I'm not getting the kind of throughput to it. You know, it's a really tough one to get right, I think.
I don't like the purees. I've had mixed results. Some batches have been great, some batches have been terrible. So I find the fruit just works much better, because you can obviously look at the fruit, and, you know, you can age it a bit if you need to. If it's not ripe enough, you can let it ripen a bit more, that type of thing. So you get that bit more control.
An extra.
Just call Jordan and figure out what he's doing. He's doing some Kraken fruit bears.
Yeah. Who's that?
Jordan at Loch Gill.
I was actually on the phone to him there earlier.
he's got those fruit ratios.
I'm fucking addicted to it. I think it was a collaboration he did with Wicklow Wolf, wasn't it? He did a salted caramel Oreo thing.
Yeah.
Oreos and a load of salted caramel went into this thing. But I'm addicted to it, and my missus loves it as well. So it wasn't up on his web shop. I'd get around there to get the last couple of cans off him.
And who else has done a good job over the past couple of years with with fruit beers or the guys down there in South London at Gypsy Hill. Like their fruited sours are some of the best you'll find. Like they're they have found that perfect ratio of they know how many kilos per liter of fruit they need. And it works.
Yeah, it's a dangerous game, especially when you're putting it into the boil and you're kind of done with it. Where at least when you're, you know, I'd be putting it more into kind of Whirlpool side, trying to transfer a lot of it over and get it into the fermenter, and then I can kind of choose when it's done and move it out of there, you know. But just throwing it into the boil like that, it's brave, like, because you know.
I didn't just go, all right, we'll do this today and we'll do it 1750. Yeah, like I did about six, seven homebrews, 20 liters, and before I got it right. And I just found that gave it the best rounded kind of fruit flavor rather than, you know, I have done it in the Whirlpool and it is, you can control it a bit more, you know, if you can pull it out.
Actually, I have two fermenting in the back room. They're just finishing bubbling there. I did a sour IPA and I put, 10% mango puree into it, that'll really sing through. And then I'm trying a new hop combination. I know a lot of guys are kind of wondering where we get these combinations from, but we brew it kind of at home and see what it's like, you know. So I've cashmere and sultana. They're two kind of, well, I've used cashmere before, but so I said I'd kind of give those a try and see what that combination is like. And,
Cashmere is an incredibly underrated hop.
It's nice.
I don't think enough people brew with cashmere.
Yeah, I tried it in, I think it was the second Asa Hayes I did. I put it with Idaho 7 and Strata, and I thought that the cashmere was kind of lost in it. I didn't think it brought enough to that party to justify its inclusion, really. I think when it went to the core range into 33 and bring the cashmere over. I brought the Idaho 7 over from that beer and the Cryo Simcoe Mosaic that I really enjoyed in the first Asa Hayes, and I combined then into the beer that we had there this evening.
Yeah, your problem with that with that first iteration when it was cashmere, Idaho and Strata is that your Strata probably dominated that party. Strata takes over very quickly, no matter what you put it with.
Balancing more of the Idaho, but then the batch size changed 2 days before brewing it. We decided the overlords decided needed twice as much, so my ratios were out then, and that was that.
One thing I wanted to bring up is earlier we were talking about hop combinations and hops that that work together and play together, and I from my practical experience, there are two hops that like just work in any scenario where you can pair them with anything, and one of those is Idaho 7. Like you can put Idaho 7 with anything, and it's going to be good.
It's definitely the hop of 2020, I think, you know. And I think it only came to Ireland really in 2020, maybe late edition 2019.
Oh man, I was when I was at Galway Bay, I was using Idaho 7 in 2017, but that's that's another thing.
When you know,
it's I remember
we should be looking out for now for 2021 and harvest 2022.
So let me tell an anecdotal little story there real quick. So when I left Galway Bay and I went to work for Loughran Brewing Stores, one of the first arguments I had with my boss was about Idaho 7, and we were arguing over how much Idaho 7 to buy to sell on, and he was trying to tell me we only need 100 kilos, like to sell to everyone. We only need 100 kilos. We only need 100 kilos of Idaho 7 to sell. And I'm like, man, you're fucking wrong. Like Idaho 7 is class. Like people are going to catch on to this. And this was in September. This would have been for the crop 18 harvest. I ended up convincing him to buy 1,500 kilos of Idaho 7 for the crop 18 harvest. And then fast forward 2 years later to the crop 20 harvest, and we're selling 15,000 kilos of Idaho 7 this year. So, to back that up, you asked what the next coming hops are. I mean, Strata is the one that everybody is absolutely loving.
I assume that the availability will be much higher this year.
Yeah. So the story with Strata is that I met at the Craft Brewers Conference in 2019. I met Jim Solberg, who is the owner of Indie Hops, who is the owner of Strata, the creator of Strata. I met him, introduced myself, said, "Hey, I would like to bring this hop into Europe." And he said, "Yeah, we'll get you a little bit for the crop 19 harvest." The crop 19 harvest, he provided us with 8 tons of Strata to sell to the entire continent. And while that sounds like a lot of hops, it's not really a lot of hops. So from crop,
you're a malt supplier from your mead, isn't it?
So for crop 19, we were allowed to have 8 tons of Strata, and then that jumped to 35 tons of Strata for crop 20, which is all but about 5 tons of that is sold. It's contracted. And then for crop 21, we have contracted and have available about 50 tons of Strata. But it's one of those that, like, somebody tries 20 kilos and they come back and want 500 kilos.
I'd say, you know, with you guys, it must be very hard to kind of judge things, because like that, you know, you sell me 20 kilos of a hop, I throw it into a beer, or you sell it to Chris or whatever, and you know, you try that and you kind of go, well, fuck, that hop is now in a core range beer. And that's something that I had with the Ace of Haze, because I, you know, I contracted a small amount of Idaho 7, you know, I was trying a few different bits, and then it became into a core range beer. So now, kind of, you know, about once a month now, I've to brew a couple of batches of Ace of Haze just for cans.
Yeah,
and my requirement has just fucking shot up. And I, you know, if you guys or, you know, one of the other hop suppliers doesn't have it, I'm in a bit of an issue there, because it's the dominant hop in that beer. So it comes back to what we had a few years ago, where nobody could get Citra because there wasn't enough of it, and somebody had just hoovered it all up, and that was it.
Well, that's where hops are, like...
Forecasting must be 2 years ahead.
Yeah, like, I've got, from my point of view, is we partner with four farms. We partner with Crosby Hops, Indy Hops, a little bit of work with YCH, Bawa out of Germany, and then now Hop Revolution out of New Zealand. And my purchasing for what we buy to sell on and contract to customers across the EU and the UK is I'm projected out for the next 3 years. And now that's not projected out for my full needs for the next 3 years. That's projected hop purchasing from a farmer's perspective is they're only going to put in the ground what they know they can sell. Yeah. And they use, farmers use contracts to decide what they plant and how much of it they plant, because they don't want to go plant 100 acres of Chinook whenever they've only got 1 acre of Chinook sold. So like it's about that sustainable ongoing relationship where nobody is overextending themselves, but we're looking at, this is what I need for the next year, because I can project that. I can't project 2 years from now, but I'm pretty certain 2 years from now, I'm going to need at least half of what I needed this year. And then 3 years from now, I know I need at least 25% of what I need now. So creating that sustainable projection from year to year.
Can you grow any hops up there?
What's that?
Are you going to grow any hops up there?
Man, Ireland is terrible for growing hops. It's too wet and not enough sun.
I know, but you could just grow some shit hops and...
There's different strains of hops, but has anything ever like come into it that you have to worry about things like the, you know, the quality of that year's, or has it ever even got towards the whole concept of terroir yet, or is that coming, or will that just be a...
Yeah, I think the concept of terroir is definitely in play. And I think that all of our brewers here can attest to. So there's consumers, people that drink beer are finally getting into the idea of they want to drink the beer that they know the guy that made it, and they can trace that back to the source. And I think that's now backing up, and brewers across Europe and the UK want to know what farm their hops came from. And if you take a hop like Amarillo, for example, which is a very large acre grown hop, the difference between Washington grown Amarillo and Oregon grown Amarillo is two different hops. Like, you can't even give them the same name, really, but they're still Amarillo because they've got the genotype of Amarillo and they come from that lineage of hop, but they're completely different. Same with Cascade, like Oregon Cascade and Washington Cascade are two different Cascades. And then you throw into the equation that Cascade is now grown in New Zealand, and New Zealand Cascade may as well be something completely different, like tastes nothing like any other Cascade out there. And terroir is extraordinarily important because as a brewer, if some of your hops are coming from Washington and you have lots of the same variety coming from Oregon, you're not going to make the same beer. It's going to be completely different. So it is important.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, it's been, believe it or not, there's an hour gone. We won't hold people's time. They've been very generous here so far. If you've been listening to this, you probably enjoy visiting a brewery and trying to, you know, tour it, learn who the people are who make the beers, see how they do it, and just get to know the local of the specifics of that particular brewery. You've probably also found out that it's quite difficult to identify which brewers allow visitors. Many don't because they don't have space, they don't have time. A lot of breweries are gypsy brewers, they don't have their own facilities. So trying to dig all that out can be quite hard. That's why I set up breweryvisits.eu. It's a directory of brewers that allow and welcome visitors. You know, it might be that they have set up tours, you know, kind of tours arranged, or that you can just call them and they're quite happy to show you around. It's still growing. We have about 300 brewers in there out of about thousands that I went through. So if you're interested in actually finding a brewer to visit when you're traveling around Europe, then check out breweryvisits.eu.